Good morning, everyone. Beautiful day in the neighborhood, isn't it? Please let us pray together. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Reading from The Divine Life, Volume 1 by Swami Ram Dass. Where is true happiness? Man ransacks 1,001 ways for attaining true happiness and peace. He thinks by accumulation of wealth he could become happy. He aims at a status of authority and power, believing that by obtaining it he could be happy. Then again, he strives to be learned and well-versed in modern and ancient lore, expecting thereby he would reap happiness. Again, he provides himself with the various objects of sense enjoyment, with a view that he would derive from them the happiness he is in search of. Thus, he cuts out innumerable avenues of approach to happiness. After all, even when he has gained all things which he desired and has fulfilled all his ambitions, he finds that he is where he was, or even far lower than where he was when he started on the quest. Divinely illumined seers of old, who have plumbed the very depths of life and have completely mastered the secrets of it, tell us with one voice that for the pursuit of true happiness, man must take his thought and vision away from the evanescent objects of external life, and going deep beyond them into the recesses of his own soul, find there the immortal source of self-existent and everlasting peace and happiness. He who has discovered this mysterious source looks upon with wonder, not uncoupled with pity, on the world in general, which is mad after possessions, riches, authority, name, and fame. Now, what is this divine source which is, by its very nature, pure peace and happiness? It is a truth which is indescribable. But then our seers have given us some indications of its existence. The truth is an invisible power that permeates all through the universe, uniting and harmonizing all things unto one homogeneous whole. In the light of this great truth, the diversity seen on the surface of universal life is realized as the variegated expression of the underlying reality. To know that we are this truth, this all-comprehensive, all-inclusive, and all-embracing reality, means to experience a state of bliss, peace, and freedom which is simply ineffable. This way alone lies the right endeavor for eternal happiness. All the sages and saints of every age and clime have striven and are striving to awaken mankind to the consciousness of the supreme happiness, which is man's real quest and goal. Now, the question is, how to obtain this happiness? We know without a resolute endeavor, we cannot get any great thing in life that we aspire for. What is needed in the first place when we embark upon the adventure of finding the great blissful truth, which is we have to conserve all our physical and mental energy and concentrate it upon the attempt at realizing this great goal. Hence, The sages declare concentration and meditation will put the aspirant on the path. By a substitution of a divine consciousness, we have the to transcend human limitations and weaknesses. As we go on devoting our thought to the contemplation of our higher and divine nature, our fettered and obsessed self is set free. When thus our ego sense, which is darkness that has enshrouded the purity and radiance of our soul, is dispelled, we come into a knowledge of our true existence, which is one with the universal life, the great reality, who is immortal bliss and peace. Concentration and meditation lead to self-surrender or dissolution of the ego sense. Man thereafter lives, moves, and has his being in the eternal. Or in other words, he becomes the very expression of the immortal splendor and inexhaustible peace and joy. Such a life is likened to the sun that sheds its light on all alike. He will thus be a power to spread love, goodwill, harmony in the world which is now veering towards the precipice of chaos and confusion. So, when a man goes in the right direction for the attainment of true happiness, which he hungers for, he will not only be himself blessed with it, but also bring about harmony and peace in the world. The first and foremost thing, therefore, is to realize the supreme state of eternal happiness for oneself, and this will automatically conduce towards the formation of a consciousness of peace and goodwill among mankind. Man would exclaim, "Oh, these things are too big for us," or "the true happiness held out is a chimera, or something that exists only in the imagination of some whose minds are not in balance." Man generally believes in the object which is right before him and yields him a touch of joy. He grabs at it without caring to understand that there is a source of higher and real joy within himself, independent of external objects of his life. There are, however, some heroic souls who have conquered the temptation of outside allurements, and breaking through the walls of ignorance, have entered into the kingdom of true happiness within themselves by realization of the supreme truth. Such are the teachers of mankind. Such are the true saviors that liberate man from the thraldom of the senses and guide him to his rightful heritage of immortal life. Every time I read Papa, I always think this is pure truth being expressed through this great God-man. And from a lovely book called Tales of the Mystic East, How Saints Change Lives. As a rule, Kabir Sahib devoted all his evenings when in Benares to feeding and serving holy men and enjoying their company and their exalted thoughts. But it happened that one evening a group of holy men visited him, and there was not a scrap of bread in the house, nor did Kabir have even one spare anna in his pocket. Kabir went to his devoted wife, Mai Loy, and asked her if she knew of any way by which they could get some food. Mai Loy said, "That man who owns the food stall in the bazaar just down the street might give us some food on credit. Do you believe that I should go and ask him?" Kabir agreed to this, and Mai Loy hurried off down the street. When she had asked the stallkeeper for credit, he smiled slyly and said, "Mai Loy, it would be a great pleasure to give you whatever food you need. There is only one condition, that is that you will come to me in the night." Mai Loy remained silent while the stallkeeper selected the food she wanted and gave it to her. Returning quickly to her home, she told Kabir of all that had happened while she was preparing dinner for the guests. That night, when it had been dark for several hours, Kabir reminded her that the time had come for her to repay the stallkeeper. At the same time, he said, "Do not worry, for everything will be quite in order. These things are taking place because I wish to bring this man to the right path in this particular manner." When she was ready, he told her, "It is raining now, and I see that the street is full of mud. So get on my back, and I will carry you to your appointment." The house was soon reached, and my Loy went inside, while Kabir waited for her outside the door. Delighted to see her and unable to believe his great good fortune, the stallkeeper nonetheless noticed that my Loy's slippers, despite the rain, had no mud on them, neither were they wet. "How is it you walk through the muddy streets," he asked, "and yet there is not a trace of mud on your slippers?" "There is nothing to wonder at, my friend. My husband Kabir carried me on his back and is now waiting for me outside the door." On hearing the name of the great saint spoken, the stallkeeper was suddenly overcome with shame. Going to the door, he begged Kabir to come inside and dry himself. Then, falling on his knees, he begged both Kabir Sahib and my Loy to grant him pardon. "Rise up, my good fellow," said Kabir. "It is a rare man indeed who does not stray from the path." Kabir and his wife took their leave, and the stallkeeper sat in the corner into the night, pondering on what had happened. In the end, he came to the conclusion that there is only one good path to follow in this world, the path of discipleship. In the morning, he sought out Kabir and became one of his most devoted disciples. Isn't that a beautiful story? I'd like to speak this morning on following the good path, the only good path, the path of discipleship. Those of us who have been fortunate to secure discipleship of a truly realized, God-realized individual are fortunate indeed. But the path and the way is two ways. As Mother said, as a guru and as a spiritual teacher, it was for her to have attained that realization, and having attained that realization, to teach others according to the truth that God has revealed to her. Our part as disciples is to follow the ways that are given to us by the guru. And if we do so, that we will come to the same state of realization that the fully realized guru has attained. Discipleship is an extremely challenging, difficult, fulfilling role to take in this world. Particularly here in the West, we don't like the role of discipleship in particular. We don't like the idea of somebody else perhaps telling us what to do or how to do things. We like to do things for ourselves. We like to experiment and find out the truth. Now, in part, this is exactly right. We should embark upon this spiritual path, following the teachings of the Master, not with an idea of being slavishly devoted and just going about non-thinkingly, taking up the path, but rather we should be good spiritual scientists. We should employ the techniques that we have been given and then notice what the results are and fine-tuning ourselves as we go along. And where we find ourselves slipping or falling from the path, then immediately getting right back onto the path and recognizing where we made an error. And so humility is a great asset and an absolutely essential virtue to have in following the path. If we don't have humility, if we don't admit in the beginning that we don't know the truth, we haven't realized God as fully as we would wish to, then we will not make any progress whatsoever upon the path at all. Now, humility runs subtle and it runs deep. There are many ways that we arrogantly hold ourselves aloof from God and Guru. And it is natural for the ego to want to do so. It wants to preserve its sense of self, the ego self. It wants to preserve its way of living. It doesn't want to be humble. It doesn't want to surrender because that implies that maybe it'll be made to do something that it doesn't want to do. Been following a diet program that is good for cleansing the liver and losing weight. It's called Fat Flush, and I've been enjoying it very much. I was talking to somebody about it, and somebody who had gained some weight over time, and they were looking for a way to get healthier. And as I described the various things that you had to give up in order to follow this, the face got longer and longer and longer. And I patted them on the shoulder and I said, the problem is you want to lose weight, but you don't want to change anything that you're eating. And this is the way that it is in all paths that we follow. In order to focus on one particular thing, we have to let go of other things. Mother asked us for some very basic, fundamental rules to follow. That we not smoke cigarettes, that we not use recreational drugs, that we not engage in extramarital sex. And so these are the things that we were asked to do. Well, inevitably, these things will come back to us. They will be a challenge to us. Any time that you set aside something and say, this I will not do, there will come times when you will feel the temptation to do it. And it really doesn't, in some ways, almost make any difference what those prescriptions are. It becomes the battlefield that we fight upon. And then in the positive, we're asked to meditate morning and night and to do our kriya and keep our vows in that way. And these are things that are really challenging to us at times. I remember a time when I just didn't want to do my kriya. I just had this tremendous resistance to it. And I would sit down to meditate and I just feel this resistance inside of me. And it was a real battle that was going on. And finally, I just reasoned it through and I said, well, I have to breathe anyway. So why not do a kriya breath? And somehow that short-circuited this resistance, and I got past it, and I was able to do the kriya breath again. But I was amazed at how strong this resistance came up inside of me to do such a simple thing. And as I say, it almost doesn't make any difference what it is that we vow to do, what we commit ourselves to do. For many of us, it's easy to start something. But we get into the middle of it, and this is true for me, and you drop it. And then you don't, then you go off onto something else because it's easy to start, it's hard to stop. Or to complete, rather. Whatever it is that you've set out to do. And so it's important that we train ourselves at completions. We can do this in very small ways. We just have a small project. We feel that we're getting interrupted in some way, and normally we might break off and not complete it for some reason. And we make a determination and we say, no matter what, I'm going to complete this. Now, it may be a very small thing, but what you're doing is you're training yourself and your will to make completions, to take it all the way to its conclusion. And that you do it perfect. Mother would hold out a very high standard for us whenever we helped her do anything. I remember her one writing about a story where they were making a fence for Mother in her backyard, enclosing the porch area. And that she came out, and it wasn't exactly to her specifications, and she made him take it down and redo it again, and that happened several times. And naturally, as you could imagine, if you were on the end of building the fence, it could get a little bit frustrating. Well, the wood isn't perfect, and, you know, it's not so easy to do, and all of that, all the objections that come up in the mind. You can just tell where the ego goes. And to surrender in that moment, to realize that the guru is not doing something out of just whim or fancy or anything like that, but is being directed by God. Jesus gave the wonderful example of those who were hired early in the day, and they were paid a penny. Now, I don't know what a penny was in those days. Maybe it was a good day's income. But the farmer realized halfway through that he wasn't going to get the work done. And that he needed to get done that day. So he went out and he hired some more people midway through the day. And he hired them for the same rate, for a penny. Well, you can imagine, if you've been working since early morning, maybe sunrise, and suddenly these slackers who've been just sitting around all day in the town square came out, they're getting paid exactly what you're getting paid. Well, that wouldn't settle so well, perhaps, with you. Is that fair? You would think to yourself. And so the farmer was getting rather desperate, but toward the end of the day, he had to get this produce or whatever it is that they were harvesting in. Perhaps it was going to rain and it was going to get ruined otherwise. And so he goes out and he hires some more people to work the last hour of the day, and he pays them the same amount that he paid the people he hired first part of the day and the middle part of the day. Now you can imagine, if you've been working out in the hot sun all day long, and here comes these slackers who come in for the final hour and they get paid exactly the same amount as you do. Might you be grumbling a little bit about that? Might you be thinking, oh, that's not very fair. Been working all day and hard like this, and I'm dirty and I'm ready to go home, and these guys are getting paid the same. There's a tremendous lesson in here, because see, Jesus goes on to point out, now you made a contract with this individual. And you said you would do this work. You were happy to do it when the day began. And it's only when you compare yourself to others that you begin to think that you've been shortchanged in some way. And so this idea of comparing ourselves to others, this is pride. And this is a way of kind of measuring your own worth in comparison to what others get. It's envy. And envy is a great robber of peace. Now, I know many people who will point out somebody else and they'll say, well, if I just had life as easy as that individual, I'd have it made. And then I talk to that individual and they're pointing out to somebody else. And they say, if I had life that easy, I'd have it made. And so on it goes. And then you get to the very top guy and he goes, gosh, it's really tough to be at the top. A lot of pressure up here. I wish I had it easier. And everybody thinks that way. And so where do you find peace then? Where do you find harmony? Where do you find your place in the world? It cannot be through measuring yourself against others. Your life is unique. Your life is yours and God's. And when you have God with you, and when you have that realization that God is with you, that is your reward. It's built right into your life. And as Papa points out here, whether God gives you a little bit or gives you a lot, it's the same. It's the same when you have God, you see. That's the great equalizer. When Papa looks out and says, the world is God. And we look out and we see poverty and lack and wars and famines and everything else. How can he say such a thing? It's because he's looking at it through the prism of God permeating everything that is. He's realized that. And that God is just as much in the smallest flower as he is in the greatest, tallest tree. It's equal, you see, when you look at it from that divine vision. Master described in the autobiography of a yogi of how he was suddenly transferred to the body of an individual who was in World War I. It was at that time. And Master was meditating in India, but suddenly his consciousness was transferred to this, I believe he was some kind of officer on a ship. And that ship had been hit with an explosive and it was blowing up and he was thrown into the water. And he is swimming for his life. This all happened while he was sitting and physically in India, meditating, but he felt that he was this individual now. And he is swimming for his life, and finally he got to shore and was thanking his lucky stars that he'd been able to evade getting death that way, when suddenly a bullet hit him and struck him down. And he could feel the life fading from him, and he knew that he was dying. And he said, O Lord, why is all of this happening? And then suddenly he was granted a vision and he saw light pervading the battlefield, the ocean, the sinking ship, the sky. Everything was filled with this light. And God telling him that in this light, everything is equal. Everything is perfect. Everything is filled with that divine presence. And suddenly he was back in India again, sitting in his lotus posture, probably very thankful that that hadn't been his final physical exit right there. But when you realize and fully take in that God's presence is equal everywhere, and that whatever your life is, the divine presence is with you. And how much we miss that. How much we mistaken it. Our attention from the moment that we open our eyes is drawn to the outside. And then we begin to think about all the things that are going to happen that day or not going to happen that day. And we feel happy or we feel sad, we feel elated or we feel depressed, depending on our circumstances. But it's all in measurement against some standard that we're holding in our size, inside of ourselves that says what happiness ought to be. If things were just equal, if people thought I was a grand fellow, if I had lots of money, if I had a beautiful place to stay in, all these things start to list through our mind. If I didn't have these money problems, if I didn't have these pressures, if I had children who behaved, you just go down the list. Then I would be happy. These are all our contingencies, you see. When we sign up with God, we think we're signing a list of contingencies. I'll be happy if you deliver on A, B, and C, and if you don't, then I'm going to be unhappy. And the unhappiness that we have is of our own making. It is our own making. Happiness is hugely a choice that we have. It is far more of a choice than what we oftentimes give ourselves credit for. We see ourselves as a victim of life circumstances, rather than as a God-realized soul who is walking through this world. And sometimes there are ups and sometimes there are downs, but it's all God. And we feel that divine presence inside of us. This is freedom. This is real freedom. Now, we can listen to the finest words, we can get the greatest teachings, but unless we practice discipleship, real discipleship, unless we put these truths into action, they are worthless. In fact, perhaps more than worthless, because when we have been taught the truth, and we cast it aside as so much garbage, and we don't even think about it, we don't try to employ it, we don't really do what is required to change our lives, then we have taken this beautiful gift that had been given to us and we've destroyed it. And there is a karmic reaction to that. Sometimes people would love to have a spiritual teacher. They really want that. And yet they can't find it, they can't find it, they can't find it. Why? In very large portion, it's because they cast it aside at one point. They asked for it, they received it. And then they cast it aside. And it's not so easy to find then, once we've cast it aside. We think, well, it came pretty easily to me this time. What's the big deal? And what you realize in your own spiritual path, it's what I realize, that there is times when the divine flow is moving through me so beautifully, so expressively. And I began to play a little fast and loose with it. Well, I don't have to think about God all the time, and I still have that flow. Well, I can do this, and I know it's not quite right, but I seem to get away with it. The divine flow is still there. There's a kind of momentum that happens, that there's an inertia that happens when you have to get first on the path. You really have to work hard to get it. And then suddenly it's flowing to you, and there's a momentum to it. And you can spend that momentum thinking that you're getting away with something, but you're creating every single minute. And as you waste that divine consciousness and that divine flow, suddenly it runs out. And now you're down in the valley. You're not where you started at. And now you have to start climbing back out of that valley. And it's a lot of hard work. And then we get up there and it's flowing again. And then we get careless again. And what you realize is that every single thought is a creation. And unless we keep our mind on God constantly, that is constantly, all the time, then we're creating some sort of separation from God. And when we do that, we pay a price to it. And then we can get to the point where we even doubt that the God experience was actually real at all. It seems like some distant dream, something that happened a long time ago. Oh, yes. Are you still into that? I used to do that meditation thing. Oh, yeah. I've moved on from there. And it feels unreal to you now. It feels so distant from you. But God has a built-in fail-safe. And that is, there is no true happiness without knowing God. And you can sample all the things of this world, but they turn into be one dead end after another, ultimately. They have their life, they have their time, they have their entertainment value, but eventually that entertainment value runs out. Speaking to somebody on the phone the other day, and they're talking about an individual, and there's kind of a sexual kind of connection there. And just wondering whether to go down that road or not, and this individual is wanting to involve other people in it, and you have to wonder, you know, what is going on here? Where is the intentionality? We have to be extremely careful with sexual energy because it is the most powerful human energy that we have to contend with. And when we transmute it, and it starts running up the spine, it is such a tremendous aid to our realization. That is why celibacy has been practiced down through the ages. And that is why we are taught to transmute this sexual energy. Now, it's not easy because it is such a powerful force. And when it starts coursing through our system, when we encourage it, then we really feel that we are victimized by it in many ways. But the truth is that we have started out by training our mind upon it, then it stimulates the body, and the body stimulates the mind, and it turns into this feedback that makes it stronger and stronger. We can cure that. We can change that, but we have to, in our minds, we have to begin to redirect that energy, and you see that energy traveling up your spine, up to the higher centers. You don't feel like you're denying yourself. When you feel the bliss coursing up through your spine, when you feel the release of energy from pressure on the nerves, and now it's going up and then to the higher points of consciousness, and when it comes into your heart, you feel that divine love. When it comes to your ajna, you see that beautiful light and you hear the om. When it goes clear to the top of the head, you merge into the infinite consciousness of spirit. And all of these are representations of complete and total spiritual freedom. And then when you look back and you look into the tiny little room of consciousness that concentrated sexual energy takes you to, and you think, that's a dim little dungeon in there. And look, it makes me a total slave of it. I enjoy this freedom. Now, that does not make sexual energy or sexual expression bad or dirty or any of those kinds of connotations. It's just simply that when we want to express ourselves spiritually, there is a tremendous force that we can have at our beck and call, that we can direct up through the spine, that we don't put ourselves into situations where that temptation grows strong, that we don't put ourselves around people that tend to draw that out in us. I remember so many years ago when I was working in a retail store, and at different times there would be different attractive ladies who would walk in through the door, and being a young man, it would produce difficulties for me. And so what I thought to do, and it helped me a lot, was I would mentally pronam down at their feet as the Divine Mother. And it would shift the energy inside of me and shift the kind of relationship that I'd have with that individual then. We have to look at all the ways that this world draws us out exclusively and denies us the connection with God. Now, Kabir taught this shopkeeper a wonderful lesson, because there are things that we think that we do in the darkness of night. But Jesus said there are things that you do in darkness that will be shouted from the rooftops. And look at what happened when Kabir, so humbly and so beautifully, brought his own wife there. And when she told him what a reaction this individual had. And you can imagine all the things that you've done in your life broadcast out to one and all. In truth, it really is. There are no secrets from God. There are no secrets. And so to live our lives as if everything is an open secret, that there's nothing for us to hide. There's no thought for us to hide. There's no word for us to hide. There's no activity for us to hide. It's all an open book to the divine consciousness. But God has sympathy on us. We can feel very bad about ourselves and beat ourselves up for what we've done. But what God wants from us and for us is for us to attune and align our lives with Him. And so everything is forgotten then. There is a young man that was being described up in Vancouver, Canada. They just recently lost their final hockey game, and they had these riots afterwards. And a young man who is an honor student and well-liked by everybody, it was very uncharacteristic for him. And he found himself putting a rag down into a police car and lighting it on fire into the gas tank and making that car explode. He's caught up in the madness of this groupthink that happens. And later on, nobody knew who he was. He was underage, and he wrote something for the paper, and he sincerely apologized for what he had done. Now, he didn't need to do that. And he put it out there. But you know, once you put it out there like that, there's no shame left then. There's nothing to hide. And your heart goes out to him. You know, you think what he did was a despicable thing. But you appreciate the character that it took for him to write that out and put it in the newspaper and say how sincerely sorry he was for what he did. It makes all the difference. It makes all the difference. And so in our discipleship, if we should fall, if we should go in the wrong direction, what God loves is our humility and to turn our back on what we've done wrong and get right back onto the path. Get right back onto the horse. Don't spend time beating yourself up. Look to what you did. Why did you do it? Where did it fall off? You can learn from that. But once you have learned the lesson, then let it go. Because everything else is just a distraction. You're actually just really giving energy to the negativity. So own full well what you have done, and then turn away from it. That is what repent means, is to turn away. Turn away from it, and get right back on the path again. Discipleship is the most challenging thing to do. And it takes great courage and tenacity. There is a wonderful saint that both Papa and Master loved a lot. His name was Swami Ramatirtha, and he had traveled here and actually lived in Northern California and Southern Oregon for a couple of years. And he lectured here, and he used to live out in the woods there. He would carry his fuel on his head. He lived very simply like a Swami down by the river. And so it's wonderful to think that we had such a great saint who stayed in this region for some period of time. And so one day, as he traveled back home, he traveled to Egypt, and there he spoke to a great Islam crowd. And he wasn't Muslim himself, but he was tremendously inspired by the Sufi saints. And so he spoke to them as one of their own. He spoke to them in Persian. And he's a genius. He's a tremendous individual. And he had command of several languages, and when he spoke in English, he spoke beautifully. But one day he went out to take a swim into the Ganges, and he never came back. But that morning before he went out, this is what he wrote. O death, take away this body if you will. I have many more bodies to live with. I can afford to live happily wearing the silver threads of the moon and the golden rays of the sun. I shall roam free, singing in the guise of hilly brooks and streams. I shall be dancing happily in the waves of the sea. I am the graceful gait of the breeze, and I am the wind inebriated. These forms of mine are wandering forms of change. I came down from the tops, knocked at doors, awakened the sleeping, consoled one, wiped the tears of another, covered some, took off the veils of others. I touched this, and I touched that. I doff my hat, and off I am. I keep nothing with me. Nobody can find me. And so that's what he wrote before he went out to the Ganges. This tremendous saint. And just think, one day, you'll leave all of this behind. All the cares, all the worries, all the accomplishments, everything that you've done in this lifetime. You will leave it all behind. But what will you take with you? You will take your God realization. You will take your character. You will take your habit patterns. These are the things that are lasting gifts or curses that you give to yourself. And so when you think about this life, you think about discipleship, you think about how you really want to live this life, we must go deeper. We must go deeper. And I would like to close now with a song of Kabir. Where is the night when the sun is shining? If it is night, then the sun withdraws its light. Where knowledge is, can ignorance endure? If there be ignorance, then knowledge must die. If there be lust, how can love be there? Where there is love, there is no lust. Lay hold on your sword and join in the fight. Fight, O my brother, as long as life lasts. Strike off your enemy's head, and there make an end of him quickly. Then come and bow your head at the feet of God. He who is brave never forsakes the battle. He who flies from it is no true fighter. In the field of this body, a great war goes forward against passion, anger, pride, and greed. It is in the kingdom of truth, contentment, and purity that this battle is raging, and the sword that rings forth most loudly is the sword of his name. Kabir says, when a brave knight takes the field, a host of cowards is put to flight. It is a hard fight and a weary one. This fight of the truth seeker, for the vow of the truth seeker is more hard than that of a warrior or of a widowed wife who would follow her husband. For the warrior fights for a few hours, and the widow's struggle with death is soon ended. But the truth seeker's battle goes on day and night. As long as life lasts, it never ceases. So let us wear the name of discipleship proudly, with humility. Let us look to this path and seek to do everything that we can to put ourselves in the way of truth, surrounded by truth, filled with truth. If we have opportunities, let us come together, join together and meditate and worship together, because as Jesus said, where two or more are gathered, there I am. There's a special synchronicity that comes when souls gather together under that auspices. Discipleship is a tremendous thing. It is the most difficult thing in many ways. But it is also the most rewarding thing that we can do in this life. Discipleship is a rare and great privilege to enter upon. Let us not treat it as trash or something of a trifle, but as the most valued jewel in our possession, and guard it with care and feel the joy of being on that battlefield, wherever it is. And please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Within you. May God and Guru's blessings ever be with you, reminding you of discipleship, bringing you into true sense of humility, and thereby entering into the mansion of joy. Om.